This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lifetime of recordings made by folklorist Alan Lomax is about to be reissued on CD. The new series, the Alan Lomax Collection, produced by Rounder Records, will include out-of-print recordings and unreleased material from his archive. Lomax, who is now 82 and recovering from two strokes, has devoted his life to the study of folk culture in America and around the world. His father, John Lomax, was one of the first popularizers of American folk songs. The father and son were the first folklorists to travel around the American South, recording songs on portable record machines. They both contributed thousands of field recordings to the Library of Congress's Archive of American Folk Song, which John Lomax founded in 1941. The first CDs in the new Alan Lomax collection will be released in April. But next week, Rounder will release a CD of recordings made by Lomax for the Library of Congress in the early 40s called Negro Blues and Hollers. This recording, made in Clarksdale, Mississippi in 1941, features Son House, Willie Brown, and Fiddling Joe Martin.
Well, if I had a followed, boys, my old second mind, I'd say I'd have been up the country my old second time.
Yes, woo. Yes.
Boy, I'm feeling low down today.
I know you, son. Go sing them old Little Cow Blues. I know you got them.
Oh, Mr. Charlie, Mr. Ludlow Joe. I done decided, oh boy, I won't work no more.
Boy, look at here. Oh, I'm going to get a cowboy dosha. Lord, put a hole in my head.
Slip your own, boy.
I'm going to get both those women for to make up my bed.
Hey, get up there, will you?
Well, look here, boy. That old mule ain't gonna get.
You've sure seen technology change in recording folk culture over the years. Now, in your early days, you used one of the first portable recording machines, right?
Actually, the first machine that my father and I took out was a Thomas Edison cylinder machine. And then the Library of Congress kindly replaced that with a disc machine that embossed the groove on an aluminum disc. But for a long time, I was a media bug because I saw that the job of the folklorist was to make a bridge between people who had no voice and the big world of communication. And that's what I did for the first, half of my life, was simply run with a recording machine and record. Here in the West Indies, in Italy, in Spain, in Great Britain, and to encourage other people to do it and to publish the results, because this was the way that people could learn that other folks were out there just as interesting as they were. That's the first big lesson of the recording machine.
When you first started recording, you were a teenager and you were on the road with your father. What were your responsibilities in those very early days?
Well, basically, I ran the machine and lifted it and carried it. The whole thing weighed about 500 pounds, and I broke it down and put it in the back of our Ford, Model A Ford, often two or three times a day. It kept the fat off of me.
Were you interested in this, or were you just doing this to please your father when you were a teenager?
Well, no. I mean, I was an anthropologist in college and a radical, and I wanted to go along to see what was happening in the South. I'd been a Southern kid, and I knew that what my middle-class surround said, which was that blacks were perfectly content with their lot, was a lot of hooey. But I couldn't prove it because you couldn't get any information on the subject. There was nobody who was talking out of school. It was too dangerous. And so I went out to see what I could find out in the background of the recording sessions. And gradually, I began to learn how to get to know blacks, even though it was dangerous for them and to some extent for me.
You and your father were, I think, the first people to actually record in prison camps in the South. Why did you want to go there to record songs?
Well, there's always been an anomaly in the black community. All secular songs, and this follows out my Calvinist hypothesis, were considered sinful. Anything that wasn't religious was sinful. So that the whole of the secular, great secular song art of the black, the blues, the hollers, the work songs, all the casual songs of amusement were forbidden. You could be church. You could be kicked out of the church for singing them if you were a black person in a respectable black community. So that it was very difficult for us to get at this rich and unknown treasure trove of American music and lyricism without in the normal black community. People were scared to sing them, scared of criticism. So we decided to go where the devils were. I mean, the people who were beyond redemption. And we found them in the prisons, and we recorded a whole literature, which is still virtually unknown. Song bag of beautiful tunes, new kinds of melodies, and all sorts of things we found in the prison camps of the South. But the blacks were overjoyed to have a chance to do something, to let their problems be known, and because they had put tremendous a lot of their feelings and sorrows into these songs.
I think the best known of the recordings that you made of prisoners was your recordings with Leadbelly, and you continued to record him after he got out.
Yeah, we did the first singer biography of him.
Let me play one of the recordings you made by Leadbelly, and this is Midnight Special. Would you like to say a few words about the circumstances under which you recorded it or the song itself? And you might want to tell us, too, how you met Leadbelly.
Well, Leadbelly had been in the Texas pen a couple of times, but we found him in the Louisiana penitentiary, where prisoners were not allowed to sing in the fields, but they could have their own entertainers. And Leadbelly was a camp entertainer. He had his guitar there. And we went to camp number one, and when he heard we were there, he ran 100 yards from his cell to where we were, arrived without even breathing hard, and sat down and sang Irene Goodnight. Was the first song he sang us, and he sang a song to appeal to the governor of Louisiana to let him out of there, because woman was mourning for him. And then he sang, among other things, the great Midnight Special, which is actually the song of the main theme song of the Texas Penitentiary. Let the Midnight Special shine its ever-loving light on you. Think of prisoners who don't know whether they'll live through the next day, who are working from dawn in the morning till dark at night, who, if they fall afoul of a guard, may be beaten to death, hanging on the bars, absolutely stone-weary, wiped out, and watching the headlight of some onrushing train flash across the walls of their prison and into their faces. That's the mood of the song.
About an A-bar and the dress she wore, umbrella on the shoulder, see the paper in her hand. Well, I'm going in at the governor, he's trying to lose my man. Let the Midnight Special shine your light on me. Let the Midnight Special shine a heaven-loving light on me. When I get up in the morning, when that big bell rings, over marching to the table, need the same old thing, not the poker on the table, and nothing in my pants. Never said a thing about it, have trouble with the man. Let the Midnight Special shine your light on me. Let the Midnight Special shine your ever-loving light on me.
That's Leadbelly, and that was recorded by you and your father?
Well, I don't know. I've recorded it so many times with him, I don't know.
I see, okay,
which
right.
Recording was which.
Did Leadbelly write Midnight Special?
No. He recomposed it. All black singers always, you know, remake it. Remake the song they sing. So they say, I'm the composer. Composed by whoever it was, even if they sing a song that's well known from some other source.
When Leadbelly was released from prison, he traveled with your father for a couple of years, and your father put on a lot of concerts for him. Do you have any memories of what it was like for Leadbelly going from the South to the North and suddenly, like, performing for folklorists, for intellectuals, performing at Harvard University? Was there a period of culture shock and serious adaptation for him?
Not at all. He was just in triumph. He, in his mind, and it was true, he was the best in the world. He was the king of the 12-string guitar players in the world. He had a voice you could hear for a mile, an absolutely beautiful silvery tenor voice. It's never been heard, by the way. It's only on our first recordings.
We're featuring an interview from the archive with folklorist Alan Lomax. Rounder Records will soon begin to reissue his lifetime of work. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1990 interview with folklorist Alan Lomax. I want to ask you about, I think, what's considered to be among the most important recordings you've ever made, and I'm thinking of the recordings you made with Jelly Roll Morton, the Library of Congress recordings, which features both him singing and playing, as well as talking about his life. How did you get to make those recordings with him?
Well, as I used a recording machine in the field, I began to discover that what an artist would say about the song at the end of a performance was usually psychologically and emotionally very revealing. And I began to record more and more of these codas to songs. And gradually, the codas began to stretch out longer and longer until I was recording whole life histories. And I had done a number of these by the time Jelly Roll came to the Library of Congress, anxious to prove to the world that jazz was not from Memphis, as Handy had said it was in a Billboard interview, but was from New Orleans. And Jelly Roll, an extraordinary intellectual he was, had the whole story worked out when he came to me in my office, which was backstage of the Coolidge Auditorium, the Library of Congress. On the stage was a grand piano. Around the hall, there were the busts of Bach and Beethoven. Jelly Roll sat down at the piano, completely at home with his peers, because he was, after all, our first literate native composer, and began to tell the story of jazz. Naturally, I was no great friend of jazz at the time, because jazz was what was driving folk music into obscurity, in my view. But this man was so fascinating that I thought I would try to find out how much, well, folklore there was in him. And within an hour, he'd said such wonderful things that I raced upstairs, got permission to work with him for a week and to use any number of discs to take down his life. That's how it all happened.
Let me play a short excerpt of the oral history that you recorded. Jelly Roll Morton is talking about when he started to play in the Tenderloin District in New Orleans.
In my younger days, I was brought in to the Tenderloin District by friends, young friends, of course. Even before we were in long pants, we used to steal long pants from around the fathers and brothers and uncles and so forth and so on.
Could you go down there before you had long pants on?
No, why, the policeman would run you right in jail. It'd run you ragged. Of course, we kids from time to time would climb those 8 and 10 feet high board fences. We'd really climb them and get away from these people, but they'd kept us right out of the district. They'd take the straps on the end of the clubs and just make switches out of them, cut our legs into ribbons, and was very frightened of, very much frightened. I happened to invade that section, one of the sections of the district where the birth of jazz originated.
Where was this? How old were you?
At that time, that was the year of 1902. I was about 17 years old. I happened to go to Villeray and Bienville. At that time, one of the most famous night spots after everything was closed. It was only a back room where all the greatest pianists frequented after they got off from work. All the pianists got off from work in the sporting houses at around 4 or after, unless they had plenty of money involved. And they would go to this Frenchman's. That was the name of the place, saloon. And there would be everything in the line of hilarity there. They would have even millionaires to come to listen to the different great pianists, what would no doubt be their favorites maybe among them.
Jelly Roll Morton, recorded by my guest Alan Lomax back in 1938. How do you think your role as folklorist has changed over the years? Or perhaps I should ask, how do you think the role of the folklorist has changed?
Well, so far as I'm concerned, I'm still doing the thing that I was inspired to do in my early recording sessions, when people would look at the microphone and say, Mr. President, I want you to come down here and help us people where we are in our hard times in this place. They looked at my father and myself as a channel to tell their troubles and to let their lives be known. That's what I've essentially tried to do all my life.
Alan Lomax recorded in 1990. Rounder Records will bring out the first CDs in its new series, The Alan Lomax Collection, on April 22nd. Here's one of his prison recordings.
I'm going home, oh yes. I'm going home, oh yes. I'm going home, Lord, Lord. I'm going home, I'm going home, Lord, Lord. I'm going home. My baby sister's crying. My baby sister's crying. Brother, come home, Lord, Lord. Brother, come home. Brother, come home, Lord, Lord. Brother, come home. I'm going home, oh yes. I'm going home, oh yes. I'm going home, Lord, Lord. I'm going home, I'm going home, Lord, Lord, I'm going home.
Last Tuesday night, pianist David Helfgott, whose painful personal history and apparent triumph over mental illness are depicted in the Oscar-nominated movie Shine, launched his 18-concert North American Celebration of Life tour in Boston Symphony Hall. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz was there. Here's his report.
I confess I was curious. I didn't care much for Shine, which I found coldly manipulative, and I'm not a fan of either the soundtrack CD or David Helfgott's live recording of Rach 3, as characters in the film keep calling Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto to prove they're musicians. Still, something in me wanted to be present for Helfgott's first appearance in this country. But I'm sorry I went. I can't remember being so thoroughly depressed by a public performance. The press ticket situation ought to have been a tip-off. Music critics were offered no complimentary tickets. Everyone is welcome to share the joy of David's celebration, the publicity director of the national tour told me. But they didn't need press for sold-out concerts. This also suggests a desire on the part of Helfgott's handlers to avoid serious critical evaluation. And now that I've shared David's joy, I can't blame them. Neither the movie nor the CDs, which are now Billboard's number one classical and crossover classical albums, prepared me for the pathetic incompetence of Helfgott's playing. Helfgott himself is an endearing figure. He came bounding onto the stage wearing a white, puffy shirt with ruffled cuffs, like the one on Seinfeld that Jerry gets trapped into wearing for an appearance on the Today Show. He trotted to the center of the stage to greet the applause, then immediately sat down and began to play a brief program that lasted only an hour and a half, including the intermission. The selections by Mendelssohn, Chopin, Liszt, and Beethoven were challenging but pretty safe. Helfgott is like a talented amateur who can handle most of the notes, but he has no focus, no concentration, and little musical understanding. His sense of rhythm is erratic. The faster he plays, the fewer notes he hits. The slower he plays, the more the musical line dissolves into a muffled muddle. What was most surprising to hear in person was his lack of any real projection or personal touch or color. No color, no poetry. Except when he suddenly played very loud, the notes were actually hard to hear. Like Glenn Gould or Pablo Casals, he groans, growls, or mutters along with the music. But the quieter the playing, the louder the vocals. People giggled, couples elbowed each other. He got more giggles in a Chopin ballade when he kept scratching his side with his right hand, simian fashion, when he wasn't conducting with it. This ballade had so little momentum, the audience thought it was over and interrupted with applause. He jumped up, bowed, then played the rest as if he were starting a new piece. The other misplaced applause came after the first movement of Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata. But this was a more excusable mistake, since the only way anyone who wasn't familiar with classical music could have known it had more than one movement was to buy a $15 souvenir program book. The people behind me were calling this event a great human celebration. Certainly, Helfgott seemed to be having a ball, grinning and leaping up from his chair to get his ovations, shaking hands with front row well-wishers. I think he had no sense of how badly he'd played. But was this a triumph over an infirmity or merely cashing in on it? During intermission, a friend came up to me, relieved to find someone who shared his dismay. "It makes me queasy," he remarked. "This isn't a concert, it's a freak show."
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. David Helfgott plays Rachmaninoff on his new CD.